Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. I'm Florence Reed. Today I'm joined by Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan is an American social psychologist, the co-author of a very famous book, a best-selling book in fact, The Coddling of the American Mind from 2018, which I enjoyed immensely. And his new book has just come out. It's called The Anxious Generation. It's all about the youth mental health crisis that is currently occurring in the United States and how one might parent a child in this age of anxiety. He has some quite radical recommendations, so I thought it'd be nice to speak to him. Nice to meet you, Jonathan.
Nice to meet you, Florence.
We're right at the tail end of your book tour. You've probably been asked every question under the sun already, so I want to run through your arguments and then get to some more philosophical ideas towards the end. Let's start by just building the case as it stands. We have this fact at the beginning of your book, which is there are record rates of youth depression currently in the USA, and those have been steadily on the increase since 2011, 2012. I can probably show a chart here to prove that that is in fact true. But I have to ask you, is this just the US or is this something broader?
Once we discovered that the exact same thing was happening at the exact same time in the exact same way in the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, we realized, whoa, there's something much bigger going on here. And this can't be because of President Obama or later Trump or school shootings or all the maladies we have in the United States. Something global is going on. Either somebody released some weird chemical into the water or the food supply of Northern Europe and North America and Australia, New Zealand. Maybe there's some chemical that was released around 2012 that especially affected young teen girls. But I think a more likely story is that that's precisely when teenagers traded in their flip phones for smartphones. With a flip phone, you can't be online all day. You can't even reach the internet. With a smartphone, not only can you reach the internet, but half of the kids say they're online almost all the time. So I think that's the most plausible explanation for the multinational synchronized collapse of mental health that hit girls and younger teen girls the hardest.
Okay, and what's the case for causation here rather than just correlation?
I mean, it could be a giant, giant coincidence. It gets less likely as you have more countries. But the way things work in the social sciences is we all know correlation doesn't prove causation. It does suggest it. It suggests it to our minds, and then we have to track it down further. There's more data. This is not just to be decided by experiments on college students or teenagers. There's also direct eyewitness testimony. When you ask young people, what do you think is causing this problem? They generally point to social media. Meta commissioned an internal study, a qualitative study, and there's a note in the Facebook files brought up by Francis Haugen that teens blame Instagram for the rise in anxiety. They say this reaction was widespread and unprompted. They didn't ask for it, but the teens spontaneously said, Instagram is messing us up. So, you know, there's lots of lines of evidence here for causation. This isn't just some accidental pattern that just happened to spring up at the same time in so many countries. The key thing to focus on is the transformation of the phones from tools that we use when we have a need and we use to connect to tools that use us for the benefit of the advertisers. So I got my first iPhone in 2008. It was the iPhone 2. And it was an incredible device. As a boy, I loved Swiss Army knives. I had a bunch of Swiss Army knives that had all kinds of tools and a magnifying glass and scissors and a fish scaler and all, it was amazing. And the original iPhone was like that. You know, it even had maps, it had music, it had a flashlight. So it was a tool that I pulled out when I needed something. That's great. But that's 2007 it's produced. In, I think, 2008 and 9 is when you get the App Store. And then you get push notifications. So by 2010, 2011, it's changing over from a digital Swiss Army knife to a portal by which thousands of companies can interrupt what you're doing and try to call you over to their app. As long as you download an app, you're giving that company the right to interrupt you and pull you in because they rarely turn off notifications. So by 2015, the life of a teen in our countries is entirely different. They now have a smartphone with social media, with notifications, push notifications, hundreds and hundreds of push notifications every day, front-facing camera, high-speed internet. So by 2015, it is possible, and as I said, almost half of American teens say they are online almost all the time. Even if they're talking to a person in face-to-face, part of their mind is on the virtual world. They're not ever fully present.
So how did we come to this point where the majority of teenagers in at least Western countries are now spending an inordinate amount of time staring at screens and particularly on social media? Because your book I mentioned earlier, The Coddling of the American Mind, speaks a lot about the kind of safetyism and helicopter parenting that existed and, your view, damaged people's robustness as they grew up. Why does this over-involved parenting not apply to social media?
The fears of parents in the Anglo countries was overwhelmingly of other adults. We were afraid of other adults.
This is stranger danger, the kind of 90s
stranger
concept.
Danger. That's right. And I thought that was a primarily American thing, but there's an amazing book by Frank Furedi, who's a British sociologist, called Paranoid Parenting. And he shows how the exact same thing happened in Britain, Canada, and the United States. And even though you don't have as much crime as we do, and the Canadians have you know, much less, even still, there was what he called the collapse of adult solidarity. It used to be that, and it still is in some places in Southern Europe, and it still is in some places, that if a kid goes out, if a kid gets into trouble, we assume that adults will help them. But we switched over to saying, if a kid goes out, we assume that adults will kidnap or rape them, and we don't trust anybody. We don't trust daycare centers. We don't trust anybody. And when that happens, we have to always guard our children. We have to be very careful who they're around. And if they're sitting home on a computer, they're safe. We felt that was safe.
They're physically safe, at least.
It was physically safe, that's right. And in the 90s and the early 2000s, as we were all discovering the internet, we all thought it was amazing. And we thought, you know, it's going to help democracy around the world. It's great that my kids are exposed to knowledge from around the world. You know, you get Wikipedia, you get all kinds of amazing things. All the way up through 2011, 2012, most of us were techno-optimists. You know, we thought this digital technology, it's a gift from the gods. It's going to strengthen democracies around the world, the Arab Spring. So during what I call the great rewiring, the 2010 to 2015 is the great rewiring of childhood in all the developed countries, childhood changes. And since we were techno-optimists at the time, we thought, well, you know, this is the way of the future. And if my kid is spending a lot of time on these amazing, you know, computers, I mean, my kid will get smart. My kid will learn how to program. None of that was true. Our kids are actually getting dumber since 2012. Around the world, students literally know less. They do worse on exams around the world since 2012, according to the PISA data set. And if you think about it, if you suddenly give all kids the greatest distraction device ever made, you give them a way to send and receive texts, a way to watch YouTube, a way to watch pornography, to play video games while they're sitting in class, you know, do you think that maybe this will make them pay attention to their teachers less? And the answer is screamingly yes. I mean, how could they not fail to pay attention when they have the entire world sitting there calling out to them, come here, play this, learn what someone said about you?
So there's this obvious distraction, this attention-seeking nature of social media, which, of course, is driven by a profit motive. The more eyes you have on screens, the more purchases you have for the products you're advertising, and the advertisers love it. It's all good. There's a happy circle of life there with kids and advertisers. But there's this other thing, which is what happens when they step away from the screen. Have you noticed the behavior of children changing over these years, even when they step away from the screens and are just in their day-to-day IRL life?
What people say routinely, what teachers say, what so many people say, is that it's just much harder to make eye contact, that especially the boys have lost social skills very, very severely. And I'm not sure if that's as true for the girls, but the boys, because the boys are spending so much time playing video games and watching porn, so for boys especially, if they want to play with each other, they have to go home to their own house alone. You can't go over to a friend's house and play multiplayer video games. You have to have your screen, your controller, your headset. So boys have really lost rough and tumble play, running around, hanging around, even just talking to other human beings directly.
The nature of the interactions are also different. You might say they're still speaking, they're still interacting in some sense, but it is very different in nature to the social cues and niceties needed for an in-person interaction. I also wonder perhaps if the sudden boom in diagnosis of conditions like autism amongst young people has something to do with the fact that to diagnose something like autism, you do take into account these behavioral factors if somebody cannot make extended eye contact.
Autism diagnoses have been increasing for decades, and that is probably partly just changes in diagnostic criteria. We've learned to recognize it better. I don't know that it's thought to be overdiagnosed. I haven't heard that. It's thought that there might also be a real rise in autism for a variety of reasons. But I have not seen anything to indicate a hockey stick pattern with a sudden increase in 2013 on autism. So a lot of things go up, but it's overwhelmingly the internalizing disorders, that is, you know, anxiety, depression, the negative emotions. It's overwhelmingly that's where you find all these shocking graphs where, you know, it's flat until 2012 and all of a sudden it just goes skyward.
So we have this social consequence. Then we also have these other elements that you're mentioning. Pornography, the kind of increased sexualization of everyday life, does seem to be quite pervasive.
Let's zoom in on the sexual development side, because I think that's something I haven't talked as much about in previous conversations. I think it's very, very important. You know, normal sexual development, let's just focus on heterosexual kids, because the problems are greatest there, because you get boys and girls moving into different online worlds and losing the ability to talk to each other in constructive ways. So on the boys' side, boys, you know, once testosterone starts kicking in around 10 or 11, you get the beginning of sexual desire in both sexes. Boys develop a very strong sex drive, and it used to be that they had to work, they had to do something to get that satisfied. They had to try to talk to girls, they wanted to get a girlfriend. But now the pornography is so available and so easy that boys are able to satisfy their sexual desires with no work, no risk of embarrassment, nothing. And it's so easy, it makes it less necessary to actually talk to girls, learn how to talk to girls, learn how to flirt, learn how to court. So boys have less motivation to do that, and they do a lot less of it.
There's the old joke that if there's a kink, there's pornography made of it, and that's even more true of now a kind of widened internet. And I suppose if you've got proclivities or ideas that are outside of the normative structure of sexuality, those are much easier to access online now, and you have no actual requirement to act in a, let's say, sexually normative way. And I'm not talking here about heterosexuality, homosexuality, I'm talking about the farthest reaches of very violent pornography and that sort of thing. So there is no requirement for you to socialize yourself sexually.
Given that Pornhub and other sites, they don't even ask you if you're 18, you just go on. There's nothing. You don't even have to lie. You just go on. So almost all kids find Pornhub or other sites, in middle school. You know, for us, that's around age, 11, 12, 13, 14. They've all seen it. And then some kids, especially boys, get lured in. The data does show that that while almost all girls have seen it, girls don't become daily users. There are very, very few girls who look at porn every day. But there's a growing number of boys. One Swedish study found it went from like 5% to 20% once we go through this period, the great rewiring. So their ideas about what sex is are shaped by this. And that means it's much more aggressive, a lot of slapping, choking, all sorts of things. So obviously the girls are being pornified. I mean, what gets them likes is adopting those super sexual poses that are copied after porn type images. So the girls are being super sexualized, while at the same time being shown that sex is this frightening, disgusting thing for many of them. And this is what the boys are watching. This is what the boys expect. This is what you'll have to do. So is it any wonder that Gen Z is having much less sex, less dating? They're going to have less marriage. They'll have fewer children. I think sexual development is pretty important. And I think we should at least protect kids from ages 10 to 15. Like, can't we at least say that from, you know, when you're 16, you can be exposed to all this crazy stuff. But can't we at least protect early puberty? That's one of my pleas in the book. Early puberty is really, really important. We have to look at what is healthy development. What did we evolve to do? What is play? You know, how do children behave from hunter-gatherer societies through or, you know, around the world? And there are certain things that are very common, certain ways of playing that are very, very common. One way to think about this is, suppose there was a toy, like in America, when I was young, I can't remember when, there was a toy called the Furby.
I remember the Furby. I wanted a Furby really badly, but my mother's very anti-American in her impulses, so no chance.
Imagine if it turned out that the Furby was so popular that once kids got it, they would spend 5 hours a day interacting with their Furby, 5 hours a day, which is what kids now spend on social media. And it's not just that this 5 hours a day means that they're doing less, you know, talking to other kids. So how would your life change? So suppose there was a toy that was so addictive that all over America and Britain and the world, kids were spending much less time with their friends, much less time outside, much less time exercising, less time sleeping. And this, the Furby is relatively harmless. So if it was just the opportunity cost, just the time, you would predict that the Furby would cause a decline in mental health, in competence, in social skills, across the board, interfering in development. 5 hours a day is a lot to take out of a kid's day. But social media is much, much worse than a Furby. It's not just that it sucks up time. It's that it very, very quickly warps your ideas of what is popular, what is cool, who should I be, what's my identity. And we give it to kids. We give social media to kids. In America, it's usually around age 11 or 12 that kids are really getting onto, you know, certainly Snapchat and Instagram, TikTok. So just as their brains are saying, okay, we're ready for the big sprint, we're ready for the big rewiring, which happens in puberty, just at that moment, we say, here is the most addictive device ever created. It's going to connect you to all kinds of strange men who want to, well, see photos of you. If you're a girl, they want to see photos of you in a bathing suit or whatever. And it's going to show you that what is rewarded is extremity. If you have a little anxiety, we're going to put you into, you're going to end up in groups of other girls who say they're anxious. And it's the ones who have, the ones who are most anxious are the ones who get the most likes, the most prestige. So, you know, I'm often told like, oh, but there are pluses and minuses to social media. One of the great pluses is that kids who have a disorder, they can find other kids with the disorder, which is a terrible idea. It is a horrible idea to let girls who are anxious about their bodies all congregate with no psychiatrist, no medical authorities, and an algorithm that reinforces extremity.
I think there is a tendency now for young people to see all of their decisions through the lens of a public-facing life. Because, of course, social media requires you to be willing to put everything you have out into the world. I am concerned primarily when I see young people using social media that they will never be able to make mistakes in private. Because what is childhood if not just a series of terrible mistakes, leading hopefully to a more informed adulthood? But if you make those mistakes in this kind of horrendously public way, how do you come back from them? How does that not affect your psyche? I find it hard to imagine it couldn't.
That's right. Now, what you said is actually a very deep psychological insight. Childhood is a series of mistakes, but the mistakes are in the service of learning. The mistakes are crucial. We learn more from the mistakes than from getting something right. And so researchers who study play say that one of the key features of play is that mistakes are not costly. So if we're playing a game and if I step out of bounds, you know, it's like, okay, you know, play's over or penalty. Or if I lie about it and I say, no, I wasn't in bounds, and then we have an argument and then I give in, that's all great. That's great. That's like how you develop these social skills of negotiating conflicts. But if it's instead, if it was like, if I step out of bounds, someone is going to take a picture and put it up and call me an idiot, and other people are going to like that picture and comment on what an idiot I am, I'm going to be so afraid of stepping out of bounds. So, you know, social media, it becomes a social control machine far beyond what, you know, what George Orwell or Aldous Huxley could ever have imagined the future would hold. Now, there's not a malevolent big brother behind it. It's a distributed big brother. I mean, for a while I was toying with the phrase, DTOTE, distributed totalitarianism. We end up with a lot of the characteristics of a totalitarian society without having a Politburo or Mao Zedong or anybody at the top dictating what it is we're going to all do.
Well, also young people are uniquely, I'd say, positioned to form kind of herds that can be vicious and cruel in ways that adults, in many cases, are socialized not to do.
Oh, well, that's right. And, you know, because Unheard features so many people who have been canceled, people who had controversial ideas, and a very common experience of having the world, it feels like the world is turning against you. It feels like you're now on the taboo list. It feels like you'll never be invited to give a talk again. Adults who are canceled in this way often think about suicide. It's very, very common because that's what being cut off and excluded and pushed out feels like. In the ancient world, there were two major punishments. Either we'll kill you or we'll banish you. And either way, social death is very, very painful for social creatures. And so for a seventh grader to make a mistake, to use a word or to get something wrong, which then blows up and leads everyone to be laughing at her or him and pointing the finger and enjoying their humiliation. I don't know if it's usually, but I would guess very often those kids are thinking about suicide because suicide is an escape. If you are being shamed, your life is a living hell. And suicide, death, you know, physical death, is much less painful than social death. So, the fact that it's the younger teen girls, they have very low rates of suicide as their base rate. But after 2012, it's the younger teen girls who go up by far the most in all the English-speaking countries. Everyone's up, but it's the young girls that really seem to turn a corner in 2013, which happens to be when they largely get on Instagram.
Why is that? Is that because girls are more likely to be swayed by these social trends, or is it social media in itself is targeting young women?
Girls and women are just much more open to what other people are feeling. They're much more influenced by this. There's a lot of research showing this. Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler showed in the studies of the Framingham Heart Study, a big study here in the United States in the late 20th century, that if one person gets depressed, that increases the odds that their friends will get depressed and also their friends' friends. It goes out a couple of steps. Emotions are shared a couple of steps. If you take up smoking, you'd increase the odds of other people smoking. So all of this is social contagion before the internet, before social media. An interesting twist on it is that for emotions, when a man is depressed, it doesn't cause his circle, his friends and friends' friends to become more depressed, in part because men don't talk about their emotions that much. But when a woman becomes depressed, it's more contagious because women share their feelings. They talk more, more heart-to-heart talks. And then the other people in their circle, especially women, are going to pick it up more. So negative emotions spread more through networks of girls and women. When we hyper-connected girls, and especially girls, because they really went for social media more than boys did, we opened all the pores on their skin. Like, okay, world, if you want to infuse me with anxiety, I'm open. Okay, everyone around me is anxious, I'm anxious too. So that's one of the reasons. Another why the biggest increases are the 10 to 14-year-old girls. 16 to 18-year-old girls are heavier users. They're the heaviest users of social media, and their mental health is much worse. But the huge increase is like more than double, sometimes 200% increases, like in self-harm. I think that's especially the younger girls, because bullying is greatest in seventh grade, which in America is around age 12. Roughly around age 12 is when the bullying is most severe. What a horrible time to put everyone on social media. Let kids work it out the old ways they used to, where, yes, you're embarrassed if you say something wrong, but it's only in front of the people who heard it. It doesn't get broadcast around the world.
In a way, it's kind of a defense of analog bullying.
Conflict and aggression and a threat, those are parts of normal childhood. Teasing, these are necessary parts of childhood. And one of the things you learn, you have conflicts and then you reconcile. Like a group of kids in a class, there's going to be all kinds of conflicts, but then they learn to reconcile. That's really, really important. Whereas when something blows up on social media, there's usually no reconciliation. If someone apologizes, it just makes things worse. So they're not learning the essential skills of conflict and resolution. They're learning to be very, very afraid. They're learning to walk on eggshells, live on eggshells, be very afraid to speak up in class. This is something I hear from so many professors. Beginning in the 2010s, they can't get a class discussion going. They can't get students to disagree with each other. They're just afraid of any sort of conflict. And so, yeah, living your life on stage is just a really bad thing to do to a child. And that's how they're growing up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Is the disproportionate effect that this is having on young girls an element of the social evolution where men would be kind of hunter-gatherer types and then later on die in wars, whereas women's way of socially punishing each other would be through social death? You wouldn't physically attack someone, you would gossip about them in the village and they would be ousted from the social group, and that would be a kind of death in itself. Is this just a logical conclusion of that, where men are slightly more immune to the idea of gossip or the negative thoughts of their community, as opposed to this kind of feminine version, which deeply fears that?
No, that's right. So aggression is different between the two sexes. And where boys were more likely, or traditionally are always more likely to threaten physical harm, or pushing your head in the toilet, or punching you. So when they all moved on to multiplayer video games, that actually took some of the pressure off. You know, nobody was hanging out behind the school after 3 o'clock where a fight was going to take place. Everyone's home on their video game consoles. And there can be no conflicts. I mean, yeah, your team is trying to kill the other team, but it's all in good fun. And there can be no disputes because the platform takes care of all the refereeing, all the adjudication. So you don't get the nutritious parts of interaction, which are the disputes. Girls, in contrast, girls' aggression has always been relational. They don't punch each other. They don't threaten to put each other's heads in the toilet. I mean, it happens sometimes, but it's not that common. With girls, it's the movie Mean Girls. It's relational aggression. They become extremely skilled at damaging another girl's relationships or her reputation.
They're masters of exile, teenage girls.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For all these reasons, girls are more attracted to social media because it promises them information about social relationships. You know who's saying what about whom. girls have a more developed social map, like representing all the people and how they're related to each other and who likes who and who's having a fight with who. Girls are more motivated to maintain that map than boys are. Boys are a little more clueless. According to the work of Simon Baron Cohen, an autism researcher and expert, boys are literally more on the spectrum. They're more towards autism, just in that they're more socially clueless, but they're drawn more towards systemizing thinking. In any case, for all these reasons, social media attracts the girls more and then harms them more. But I hope we'll switch over. We should talk for a bit about the boys, because once we expand, you know, when I started the book, I thought it was going to be about social media and girls primarily, because that's where the evidence of the link is clearest. But after a while, working with Zach Rausch, we figured out the story on boys. They're doing much worse than they were in 2010. Their rates of depression and anxiety and suicide are also way up. But we don't see this sudden change in 2013. With boys, we don't see this sharp change. We see a gradual increase beginning a few years earlier, beginning in the late 2000s, and then ramping up so that they often end up with a 50 or 100% increase, but it's more gradual. And we think what's happening there is that boys have been withdrawing from the real world since the 70s and 80s for a lot of reasons. Society used to value physical strength, the economy, the job market. There were jobs that men could do that required you to be strong, and those jobs tended to pay more than the jobs that women could do. So as that has changed, men have lost status and employment opportunities, while women have been gaining and rising. And that's all that, you know, for women's progress is all great. But relative to girls, boys have been declining since the 70s and 80s. They're not doing as well in school. They're not going to university as much. They're not even getting employed as much now. Part of what's happening is the virtual world has just gotten more and more amazing since the 80s. When I was a kid in the 70s, Pong came out, this video game where you could hook it up to your TV, turn a dial, and you play sort of like tennis or table, like ping pong with a friend. And it was quite amazing because it was on TV and you were controlling it. But it wasn't beautiful. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't this immersive environment. It's just a game. And you played it with a friend sitting next to you. But over time, the video games have gotten more and more amazing, more beautiful, more exciting. They're evolving in a Darwinian sense. Whichever game hooks kids the most, whichever game makes the boys say, oh my God, this is so amazing, I'm going to play it all day long, that's the one that wins. And this Darwinian process has given us these incredible video games of today that really lure the boys in.
So they're becoming increasingly isolated because of that. Though I would say, perhaps even just to defend the video game industry, which is very unlike me, someone who absolutely loathes the things. But I would say that at least with a video game, even if boys are completely atomized in their own front rooms playing a game on a pair of headphones, they are at least playing the same game. This is where social media becomes, in my mind, so sinister, that what you see on your social media feed is entirely tailored to you. It's utterly atomized in the most isolating, disenfranchising way. You have nothing that you can say, hey, I got to this level on my Zelda game. You can see how old school I am. I haven't played a game since then. But you can speak to other people about the narrative of a game, even ones that have different solutions.
That is a great point. It's one I had not thought of, I have not said, but I'm going to start to say it. I'll try to remember to credit you for it.
No worries. You can have it. It's fine.
So, you know, what I say in the book is that one of the key features of virtual interactions is that they're generally asynchronous and disembodied. And so girls reading through each other's posts and liking and commenting on them, it's asynchronous. You post, you wait. So at some point, someone responds, but you don't know why is she not responding? Why is he not liking this? So asynchronous interactions are bad, or at least more anxiety provoking. Whereas video games, or like what we're doing right now, where we're, you know, this is a synchronous interaction where we're doing turn taking. So you're right to defend video games by saying that they are talking. It is synchronous. That's the point I've made so far many times. But you're adding that when you're talking, you have a shared world. It's a virtual world, but you're all moving through a computer representation of the same world. And if I think you're around a corner, then you are around the corner.
Exactly. Or even in the more philosophical sense, a kind of language game, which where you have shared rules. So you can't break the rules and you can't exit the paradigm It also has shared narratives, shared morals, like you would from a film or a TV series, which is why I imagine you don't see massive increases in mental health crises after the invention of Netflix, for example. It feels like that's something that you might go into work or school the next day and talk to someone about. Social media is the ultimate atomizer in that it brings you just so much closer to yourself.
I do totally agree, but let me just add one point onto what you just said. So again, the shared reality is a very important point. I like that a lot. If we're just looking at the mental state of boys versus girls at the age of 16, then I would agree with you. Yeah, the social media is much more pernicious than the video games. Now, the video games do addict between 2 and 15%, depending on your criteria. 2 to 15% of the boys do get addicted, and that is very serious because that could cause permanent brain changes if they're addicted for years. You know, a week of binging is not going to do anything bad. But, you know, if you're playing 3-4 hours a day for years, that's going to change your brain. So it is bad for that subset of boys. But the larger point is, while the girls seem to be worse off at the age of 16, the boys, what they're doing is they're precluding their ability to turn into men. They're precluding their ability to grow strong, tough, productive, persistent. They're precluding their development of the ability to talk to girls and women. And so I think what we're seeing is young women are outperforming young men in the job market. They're more focused on getting a job, on being self-supporting. And a lot of the young men are just turning into losers who have no skills and no motivation. So if we check in on Gen Z in 10 years, when the oldest are 38, I think what we're going to see is that the boys might actually be more impaired in life than the girls are. Even though the girls are more depressed as teenagers, the boys will be more incompetent. They'll earn less money. They'll be less likely to have a full-time job. And so I think it could end up being worse for the boys.
What an irony, though, that it is on social media that you find these anti-fragility influencers, figures like Andrew Tate, who are really making millions off telling boys to be less fragile, more robust, more masculine, to return to an idea of the kind of work that they might have had that disappeared prior to the age of Pong. What's happening there? There's a complex economy here in which people who have been neutered by the addictive nature of social media and games are then being told by figures on social media that they need to man up, get outside, touch grass is the phrase, and kind of reconnect with the world.
Yes. So it seems to me when I'm a professor here at New York University. I teach undergraduates and also MBA students. And it seems to me when I talk with my students, it's like, you know, it's like their whole world, their whole imagination is the virtual world. So if they have an idea for a business, it's going to be for an app or it's going to be, to be an influencer. If they have an idea of how to create social change, it's going to be to create an app or, a YouTube channel or something like that. It is kind of like they were born and raised in a spaceship in outer space. And the whole world is just the spaceship and they don't think about things beyond that spaceship.
Whenever I ask young people what they want to do when they grow up, I hear, I want to be a YouTuber, which is terrible because I worry about what that means. And secondly, because I'm a YouTuber, so I can't say, no, don't do that. That's a terrible idea. So I'm kind of stuck in this trap all the time.
Yeah. Well, but one thing I've noticed is the old way was you get excellent at something and then you have the right to be an expert on it. And then you might have a YouTube channel. If you're a great chef, if you're, whatever you are expert in, you now have a right or a reason to say, now I'm going to get my message out. But I've had a number of conversations with Gen Z students who are basically approaching this as, how do I build the largest audience? My plan is to build a really large audience. Okay. Why would people follow you? They don't like, what do you mean? I'm just trying to get followers. Like, they don't seem to understand that you have to become excellent first, because now you don't have to become excellent first. There's what's called famous for being famous. If you get a lot of if you get a lot of followers, then you are excellent. You're an influencer. So I think, again, growing up on stage, if you're born and raised, I don't know if you remember the movie Truman, he's raised in, it's a giant media show where it's a fake world. Actually, that's not a good example because he doesn't know he's on stage. What we'd want is more like a bizarre, like I've just actually listened to Brave New World right now. I haven't read it since I was 14. It's an amazing book. But what we'd need is if we imagine raising children on the stage every moment of their day, there's an audience. It's either applauding them or it's booing them. Every moment, when they go to the bathroom, when they shower, when they get dressed, every moment, there's an audience. Like, you couldn't possibly grow up in a healthy way in that circumstance.
So the solutions, because we're kind of agreeing too much here. So I want to start challenging some of these solutions.
There are four simple norms that we can do. The book has, you know, 50 different suggestions, but four norms are the important ones. Three are about the phones and one is about play. So the four norms are no smartphone before high school or the end of secondary school in the UK. No social media before 16. A lot of us are honing in on 16 as the reasonable dividing line. Phone-free schools. And the last one is far more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world. Because if we're going to reduce screen time for kids by 50%, 80%, some large number, we have to give them something to do. And why not give them back the play-based childhood? Why not give them back the freedom that we stole from them? Not stole, but we mindlessly took from them in the 90s. Give them back the freedom, encourage them to hang out. You know, I live in New York City. You know, I tell my kids here, go to Coney Island, like this amazing amusement park. You know, I'll give you, you know, I'll buy you all passes. Go to Coney Island. They go on the subway themselves. They have a great time. So encouraging them to have more real world adventures gives them a good childhood.
The first obvious challenge will be from the libertarians, who might have been big fans of yours a few years ago when they read The Coddling of the American Mind, and now might have become your erstwhile enemies. Because, of course, this is bearing all the hallmarks of a kind of nanny state, government overreach, intervention into parenting, and a prescription of how we should parent our children. So what is your argument against those libertarians who would say, hands off my kids?
I love libertarians. I'm pretty libertarian when it comes to adults. But the point that I make that they really seem to get is children are different. And especially things about sex and addiction, you know, sex, cigarettes, heroin, anything that's, you know, about sex or addiction, there is a role for government to say that there's a limit, that there's some age limit. A lot of libertarians do get that. Also, I say to them, this whole problem was created by Congress passing two terrible laws, one of which said you have to be 13 to give away your data and sign a contract and without your parents' knowledge. Oh, and the platforms have no responsibility to check age. Just as long as you say you're 13, you're fine. That's a terrible law. Another law they passed, Congress passed, was to say parents, platforms can send whatever garbage they want to your kid. You can't sue them. You can't sue them for whatever they show your kid. You're not responsible. So you put those two terrible laws together, and I say this is creating an environment in which parents can't raise their kids the way they want. If you want to keep your kid away from hardcore porn and strangers reaching out to them, you have to keep them away from the web. You have to keep them away from any browser. Yet, you know, you'll have to see what are they doing at school? What are they doing at a friend's house? So the situation at present is not one where I'm asking for the government to come in and tell parents what to do. It's, can the government undo its mistakes and give us a hand here so that we can raise our kids the way we want? So I don't think parents should give their 11, 12, 13-year-olds a smartphone. I say wait till high school. But I would not want a law in the United States saying that parents can't do that. You know, as an American, that just feels wrong to me, that level of intrusion. But social media is different in that social media is such a trap. Social media is not just like an individual choice to smoke. So in the United States, the peak year of teen smoking was 1997, when 37% of American high school students were smokers. That means that almost two-thirds didn't smoke. Social media is much, much more addictive, because it's socially addictive. In you know, almost all American high school students are on social media, and they have to be because everyone else is on it. So I think we because it's a collective action trap, government is one of the most powerful ways to liberate people from that trap. And I think social media, it just conveys so many harms in so many ways. I mean, you know, violence, sex, drug sales, strangers talking to your kids. I do think that here we really do need a minimum age. And I found when I've debated with libertarians, if I focus on children, then I actually can win them over. They want to focus on adults, which is fine. I'm a libertarian too about adults. So I think if we focus on children, the libertarian case looks a lot weaker.
And how do we avoid a situation in which there is a kind of elite retreat, which I've already noticed starting to happen, where the ultra wealthy, especially the children of billionaire tech moguls, it seems, go without social media, go without new technology and live a kind of 50s-style lifestyle, while the masses who depend on this technology to live their day-to-day lives, to exist in menial labour, to actually get jobs and maintain jobs, they are stuck with it, whereas the ultra elite are able to kind of slough it off.
So working class people they have fewer resources. They're less likely to be married. It takes a lot of time to supervise kids on the internet and in life. So kids in lower SES families and single parent families spend more time online than those in more educated, married families. So there's reason to think that it's doing more harm, that the current environment does foment, it does increase inequality, psychological outcome inequality, I think is probably taking place. The solution or the solutions that I've been proposing are almost all voluntary. In the American context especially, I was assuming that we'll never get help from Congress, that we have to do these four norms on our own. And it's becoming increasingly clear educated, wealthy parents are going to do them. In fact, I've heard from a number of people have emailed me, said, you know, one guy in our school bought a copy of the book for every family in the school. Now, this is obviously a wealthy private school where you've got people who read my book and they say, yes, collective action. We all have to do this together. So I do think that, as you say, the people who invented the technology generally don't let their kids use it because they know what it does to kids. Wealthy, educated people, I think, have been really afraid of this, of what this is doing to their kids. And now that they have a plan of action, now they are all, a lot of them are really congregating around the four norms I proposed. The one norm that will promote more equality is the phone-free schools. Because since kids from low SES families are spending more time online, they're more heavily addicted. So if every school in America and Britain were to say, you get 6 hours off every day, you get 6 hours away from your phone, that will actually help working class kids and poor kids from poor families more than it will help kids from rich families.
Some more meta questions here then. If we put these principles into action, what happens when we have this very jarring transition for young people in 15, 25 years' time, once we have imposed these rules on them, where they go from having a 50s style organic childhood with lots of free play and analog experiences to a techno-futurist reality once they hit 16 or 18.
All of us adults, at some point we encountered social media, and it probably took us about a week to learn it. You know, it's not like it's this big traumatic thing that is going to take you years and years to learn. These are incredibly easy products to use. Also, it's not as though they will not have been on a computer, or they will not have been on the internet before. They will. I think a pretty healthy thing to do is have a desktop computer. If you've got kids, it's fine to have a desktop computer in your house, have it in the living room, have it in the kitchen. There's a place and a time when your kids, you want your kids, even 7, 8, 9-year-old kids, you want them to be looking things up on Wikipedia, watching videos on YouTube. What you don't want is for them to have their own personal device that they can take into their bedroom and fall into, and then you don't see them again. That's what you have to avoid. So if we have gradually loosening restrictions, which is what I'm proposing in the book, and we are giving kids a lot more responsibility in the real world, they're learning how to be self-governing, then when they're 16 and they open an Instagram account or a TikTok account, it's going to damage them a lot less than if they had done that at the age of 11. So I'm not at all worried about that. It's like smoking. Like, oh my God, what are we going to do when kids turn 18 and they can smoke cigarettes? Oh my God, like, we better let them start smoking earlier so that they're ready for it. Like, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Making something illegal often makes it seem cooler to young people. I mean, it's happened again and again. It gives a kind of patina of punk to whatever it is. Facebook was an example in my day of something that started with lots of young people joining and has completely petered off as something that young people use, and in fact has now become mainly used by older people. Is that not just naturally going to happen to these different platforms as time goes on?
No, because what you're talking about is the old days where kids wanted to do something, and when parents said no, then that made it more desirable. But this is different. With social media, when you talk to young people, they see that it's harmful. There are very few. I've been looking for members of Gen Z who defend the phone-based childhood. I can't find them. I cannot find them. You don't see any Gen Z organizations saying, hands off of our smartphones. You just don't find that.
It feels like an interesting rebellious moment then, that it is the young people who have lived their lives so much through this technology, in this technology even, who are turning against it.
Exactly. That's right. And that never happened with television or comic books. So there were previous moral panics. That's the main opposition argument I get. Oh, this is just another moral panic. This is just like television and comic books. Really? With television and comic books, were there young people organizing to say, please liberate us from television? Or please liberate us from comic books. Well, you know, no. The young people liked it. The adults were concerned. It doesn't seem to have been harmful. This is very different. One reason I think that my book is selling so well is because everyone has seen it. Everyone has seen the problems, either in their own kids or in other children they know. Everyone knows someone where there's a kid in the family who is suicidal, who's cutting herself. So this is not a moral panic based on trumped up media reports that are very rare. This is happening all around us every day. We all know people. Everyone's sick of it. Everyone's ready to rise up and say, you know, let's get out of this. And what I'm trying to say is it's hard to get out of this by yourself. It's easy to get out of this if we do it together.
Jonathan Haidt, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Thanks, Florence. Okay, bye-bye.
What Jonathan is speaking to there in his book and in that conversation does seem to be a wider concern. It is one of an over-technologizing of our day-to-day lives, about the dystopian and increasingly atomized existence that many young people have, and the potential futures for a world in which everybody spends the most of their time staring at a screen. You, of course, by watching this, unless you're listening to the podcast, are probably staring at a screen, so go outside and do something fun. We'll see you next time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.